www.lifeinsurance.com/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663.
Listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. We're excited about an upcoming event at Cal State LA. It's a special performance by Alice Bag and her band, organized by the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. And it's going to be followed by a discussion and a Q&A with Alice and culture scholar and punk drummer Candace Hansen. And we're now joined by Alice Bag and Candace Hansen to hear all about it. Alice Bag is a feminist punk icon and author. Candace Hansen is a musician, journalist, and zinester. I mean, they both have many other credits, but those are the main ones. So welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Alice, let's start with you. The promo for this Cal State LA event actually says, CSU LA alum Alice Bag is coming home. Is this true? Are you an alumna?
Yes,
yeah,
I am.
And
yes,
how do you feel returning to your alma mater?
I feel totally lost when I go. Everything has changed. But it's so exciting to watch the campus. It's flourishing. And I'm happy to be welcomed back. It's nice to be home. It is.
Mm-hmm. It's just like a whole circle, right?
Except less parking.
That's a trouble everywhere. That's a problem everywhere. So how do you feel Cal State LA was kind of part of your whole creative development looking back?
Well, I feel like Cal State LA helped me really fine-tune my ideas and find ways to express my ideas. I was a philosophy major, so I had to like support my arguments all the time and analyze different positions. And I feel like it helped me grow as just a critical thinker. And I feel like I put a lot of that into my lyric writing nowadays. So it helped me in that way.
Yeah, that's huge. And in fact, I think the philosophy department is co-sponsoring this event as well.
Yay! Philosophy department.
So yeah, it all comes together. And let's tell our listeners how the two of you met and how you work together. So, Candace, why don't you start with that?
I think we met at Rock Camp, right?
Yes.
Actually, a pretty cute moment. Alice, me, a bunch of other people were volunteering at Chicas Roqueras, which is like now goes by Chiquex Roquerex, which is like a gender inclusive way to use language to reflect the multitude of trans and queer youth and volunteers who are a part of that organization, part of the wider kind of Girls Rock international network of feminist pedagogy through music. Yeah, Alice was volunteering there and she had asked my friend Marin to play drums for her during the lunchtime band. And it's very cute. The volunteers will, there's one day, it's kind of legendary. All the volunteers do a song for the kids. And so Marin was like, you don't want me to play drums. You want Candace to play drums. And like, kind of like went and got me and was like, you should play with Alice. Like I'm rusty and I have to like clean the kitchen or something.
Organizers always cleaning something. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You know, at the end of the gig, who's sweeping up, it's always a dyke, right? So, So anyways, yeah, so we played together and we just really hit it off, and we hit it off as friends at camp, and yeah, we started playing together later that year.
Yeah, and you've been playing with the Bags on and off all of their tours ever since.
Well, this is Alice Bag Band. So the Bags, mm-hmm. Alice can tell you about mm-hmm. the Bags. Bags broke up in the 80s, but I've been playing with Alice about, yeah, since then. So a little over 10 years.
Wow.
And yeah, it's really, I love Alice's relationship to making music, because she, like in all the early records, there was kind of this like family of people. It was like kind of a collective that were making these Alice Bag records. And I was really honored to be, especially like 11 years ago, I was like, kind of like not as confident in myself. And I think like playing with Alice and the collective really helped me kind of find who I was as a person, which is a really beautiful piece of my legacy that I get from playing in Alice's collective. But yeah, there was a lot of different members. There's another drummer named Ricky, who's incredible, who plays on some of the songs. And, but yeah, we've played together. I've done most of the tours. One legendary Limp Wrist show I couldn't play because I was doing my MA exam, which is a bummer. But yeah, I've played most of the tours for the last about 10 years.
Well, I think with the records, it was a lot of different people, because I'd been playing for many, many years and had a lot of friends who were, most of my friends are musicians. So I wanted to bring in as many as were available during the time that we had in the studio to come in and even play on one song or two songs. I think Candace, I think that first time you played on three or four songs. And then as things progressed over the years, Candace just started playing a lot more with me. She did a lot more of the gigs. We started touring together, and it just kind of coalesced into this being the core group, the one that's playing now. So we're the Alice Bag Band. And this is it.
We're So this event is all about sort of celebrating punk history and feminist resistance. But seems like often those two can be in contradiction. Alice, can you tell us a little bit about how you've been part of making space for women and queer folk in punk with the Bags continuing now? Some of those stories.
Well, first of all, I don't think that punk and feminism is in any way in conflict. I feel like punk means inclusive, and it means like being an agent of change, positive change. So I feel like the people who should be worried about whether they're punk enough are the people who are creating barriers for women and people of color and queers. And if you're doing that, that's not punk. So I feel like let's just own it. Punk is what we're doing now, which is inclusive. Inclusivity, feminist, queer, gender, sexuality positive.
And Candace, we first met when you were running Rock Camp for Girls OC a long time ago. I don't even know what year that was. So you've always been about making space for women and queers in the music world, and kind of relating to what Alice was just saying. How do you think punk creates a space for outsiders, for folks outside the gender binary, for anyone who rejects social expectations?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, what's interesting is like, you know, just in my work as a historian and also in my life, it's like basic understanding of punk is that it's a place for deviants and freaks and misfits. But then there also is this other side of punk that is very rigid, right? But it is a welcoming space for the things that society doesn't necessarily always make space for. Like even at its most basic, you know, operating way, it's a space for rage. It's a space for sadness. It's a space for despair. You know, it's a space for frustration and anger, right? Like, and so I think like people who are experiencing the challenges of oppression, right? Like it lends itself so easily to become a space where you can move through those feelings that don't really have anywhere else to go, especially like as a transmasculine queer dyke. Like, you know, butch dykes are already read as freaks everywhere you go, right? And so like when I was young, I actually like was really inspired by this organization called Girl Fair, which was like a queer feminist festival that happened in Santa Ana every year that was led by brown punks who were all queer and trans, right? And so like those friends were the ones who like really provided the first space for me to really feel like this is who I am, and like this is how we can use like these tools from punk and from Riot Grrrl and from feminism and bring them all together to move through the bullshit of life and to like make this place better for everyone. And so like, to me, like the best parts of punk are always those that are created by people who are furthest at the margins, you know. It is a genre that belongs to everybody for better and for worse. But yeah, I think like what queer and trans people and people of color are doing with punk is just so inspiring.
And your dissertation, you just finished your PhD, and you write about how queer and trans people use punk as a strategy of survival, right? What does that look like?
You know, I was thinking about Alice, actually. Alice, and I was thinking about like this band Gloss, and I was thinking about my friends from Girl Fair, so Jonathan from the Bellhaunts, and all of these people who I knew personally in my life, but also who I was just like a deep fan of their work, like that literally were writing about surviving and using punk as a way to do it. And I would see it in real time, how it would inspire other people. So like Alice told me a really beautiful story about writing the song Survive. I don't know if Alice, if you feel comfortable sharing that.
Go ahead and share it, because I don't even know what story you're going to tell.
Well, you told me how you and Patricia wrote Survive.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you guys were kids. Like, I don't know. Could you share that story?
Well, we wrote it in Patricia's garage, and we had another guitarist. None of us had the language to communicate what we wanted to hear musically. So we just would hum out a part, and then the woman who was playing lead guitar would pick it out, and we'd go, oh no, it's like da 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 da, and then she'd pick it up. The whole idea was we did not have the tools, but we just made it work, and I think that's the most punk thing.
I'm really interested to hear what you say about how you think performance functions as activism as well. What does that look like for you, Alice?
I think performance functions as activism for several reasons. One is that you create community. When you have a concert and you have people dancing together, and you have people hopefully listening to the lyrics of the song and connecting to them. And I feel like music is in a unique position to connect with people on a deeper level, on a physical level, on a cellular level. We are made of water. Our bodies vibrate. Sound waves vibrate, messages get in there, you know, at the same time as your whole body is resonating with the message. So I feel like it's really powerful. So when we're doing a song like No Means No, and we have the whole audience jumping and dancing with us and singing with us and saying No Means No, I feel it. I feel it in my soul. And I feel like, you know, I feel like we're really just kind of putting a message out in the universe. And I know that sounds a little hippy dippy, but that's okay, because I feel like people walk away from the concert feeling like they have agency, like they have power, and like they have community. And those things are really important for creating change.
For sure. And we are here for the woo-woo. Candace, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with what Alice said. I mean, there are so many, I mean, we've been playing together for over 10 years. It's been crazy, like, just being on tour. Like, when you sing something, or, you know, I'm a backup singer, so I'm not saying the words, but it's like when you have a song that represents an idea, what's really special about being, like, a queer feminist punk band is, like, Alice and I are the ones doing the merch. And so people, like, want to come and tell you about what they're doing that relates to the thing that you're representing on stage. And it's like, you know, visibility and representation is such a double-edged sword, right? Like for my generation of elder millennials, we were promised that visibility was the path to a livable life. And unfortunately, we see the backlash to that in today's legislation. But at the same time, it's often the visibility of people like us on stage, on television, in print, that makes us feel like we can live, right? Or that makes us feel inspired to keep going. And so there's been so many times that we've played a show and then I'm doing merch or we're doing merch, and people come up after the show and they want to tell you about what's going on in their community, right? And it's really beautiful, because then, like, especially like in my early days with the band and when I was really actively still doing rock camp and doing a bunch of other stuff, you know, like people would be coming up talking about anti-gentrification organizing in their community. I remember once we played in Detroit and we played this club and all these young women who were organizers came up and you can smell another like dyke organizer from a mile away, you know? So these kids, they were so sweet. They came up to me and they're like, who are you? And we're just like chatting and they're telling me about all the issues that they're protesting against. And they have this small collective, but they just really believe in what they're doing. And it's like that kind of thing happens in every city. And so then it's really cool because it's like, you're kind of like on, you're on, literally on the road playing these gigs. And then you're talking to people and then you're like, oh my God, do you know this person? I was literally just having the same conversation with this person in another city, right? And then like making those connections, like I think just knowing that people aren't alone is a really important part of music, right? For me and for other people who I've spoken to, but also just like the ability for music to like help you imagine a different reality than the one that you're in. That's part of the beauty of the medium, right? Like there's a reason Sun Ra uses music to talk about other worlds, right? It's like through such an intangible form of art, we can really imagine something beyond the kind of prison house of the here and now, as Jose Munoz calls it, right? So I think, yeah, it's integral. I mean, look at all activists of the 20th century. Music is a big part of their life too.
For sure. Love how you slid in the Jose Munoz quote as well. That was really well done. So we are joined today by our feminist magazine intern, Jimena Vasquez, and she suggested this interview today. And one of her questions was about how you both got started, how you actually found the punk scene. And this is a kind of question I often get from students when I talk to classes is like, how to start in activism, how to start in music, how to start in any self-created life path. So Alice, how did you find this? You were a philosophy student. How did you find punk?
Well, I found punk first, actually. Music was something that saved me because I was bullied in school. I was a total weirdo, an outcast, and music was something that I would take home and just listen to and read the lyrics and buy magazines about rock and escape into music. And I was a fan first. That's the short answer is you're a fan first, start going to concerts, you start meeting people that are also fans, you suddenly find that you're part of a community. And there is like a community of just like concert goers in any town where you know like who's going to be there. You become friends, you support each other. You feel like I can go to a concert with friends or I can go by myself because I'm going to know people there. And when you get to that point, then you start thinking, well, maybe I can make my own music. Like, I feel like I have other friends in here who might be interested in doing something. And I think the thing that I felt was superfluous was really feeling like I had to be trained. I feel like taking guitar lessons, it didn't really help me in joining a punk band. Later on, I learned to play guitar on my own without like formal training. So I feel like, yes, if that's your route and if you want to study an instrument or study music, that's great if that works for you. But that don't let that be a barrier. It's not necessary. Not for punk, at least.
No, for sure. Candace, how about you?
Well, like Alice, I was a bullied youth, but I had a really close best friend in junior high named Sarah Long. We were freaks. We were nerds, but we were like kind of like freaky nerds, you know, like we weren't like other nerds. And one day she was like, we're going to be punk. And I was like, what does that mean? And then she like invited me over to her apartment and like played me a Sex Pistols CD. And I was like, oh my God. And yeah, it was kind of like because my friend kind of was like, look, these people are freaks too, but they're cool.
Yeah.
And they're nerds. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is totally like us. And so I was from, my family was really, you know, we were very working class and her family was middle class. And so they had a computer and this is in the early 2000s. And so she would go on Napster and she would just look up whatever she could find from like LA punk. And so she downloaded all these cool, like, one of the first CDs ever she burned me was a Screamers CD, which is like, wow. That's such a wild, like, right? Yeah. Like a wild CD to get. And I was like, yes, this is me. Let's go. And so, yeah, I just like my friend Sarah just burned me all these cool CDs from her family's computer from Napster. And we like, my mom, we used to get vouchers to go to the thrift store because as part of welfare in the 90s. And so my clothes were already punk without even knowing it. Cause it was just like whatever freaky kind of thrift store shit I could slap together. So it just really worked out for me. And then I always wanted to be a drummer. And so my freshman year of high school, I actually like made a deal with this football player who like heard I wanted to be a drummer. And he was like, his grandpa had just died. And he was like, oh, we have a drum set we're trying to sell. And I heard you want to be a drummer. And so I got on a payment plan and I would give him my lunch money every week for like almost the whole year. And I would like, this, like my first history of dodging creditors. I was like hiding from this man.
Today I want lunch. Today I'm not going to pay you.
Exactly. My poor mom, like she just didn't have money. So anyways, I financed this drum set. I actually still have it's in my studio. Part of it, the red Tom Tom is on my shelf, but yeah, I got this drum set and then I just taught myself to play drums. I got a book from the library and I taught myself and I just like listened to all those punk CDs that my friend burned me. Those like 70s and 80s LA punk CDs and would just try to learn to mimic the beats. And it just became like my safe space, you know, even though punk was also so violent and hostile. But yeah, that's kind of how I got into it. And I've never stopped drumming since.
I love the payment plan story. It was like, do it any kind of way. Alice, let's talk a little bit about your writing. Your memoir, Violence Girl, talks about growing up Chicana in East LA. So how did that, the environment and your growing up, how did that shape your voice and your whole experience as an artist?
I mean, I feel like everybody's, where you grow up makes a difference to how you see the world. I grew up during a time when I started school, I couldn't speak to my teacher because I spoke only Spanish when I started school. So I feel like that immediately set me on the wrong side of society. And it also, you know, it was a bad start. It was very negative. As I got older, I had a teacher who changed my name from Alicia to Alice. And it just kind of stuck with me over the years because she told me that was my American name. So I stuck with it. You know, I even have documents. I think at Cal State, I'm under the name Alice, maybe, possibly.
Wow.
So it changed me right from the beginning. I also had the opportunity to have an older sister who was involved in the walkouts and I had the opportunity to go to the Chicano Moratorium. So all these things shaped my point of view. I didn't immediately feel like I was welcomed into the Chicano movement. I think there was some parts of the early Chicano movement that were controlled by very conservative and male-dominated voices. And I think that changed over the years. I mean, I've had the chance to talk to some of the Chicana elders who were involved in planning the moratorium, and they've confirmed that there were still a certain amount of, you know, patriarchal values that were being clung to that kept women in secondary positions. And they rebelled. There was one particular Chicana icon who formed Adelitas de Aslan, and she created the Clínica del Barrio. She fought back and created her own movement. Mm-hmm. Her name is Gloria Arellanes, mm-hmm. but she was an influence. And of course, like the work of like Dolores Huerta, all those things, like all those women were influences on me.
And Candace, for you, how did where you grew up influence how you got into your creative and scholarly self?
I mean, it's a good question because what's interesting about Orange County is like growing up in Garden Grove, it is like people outside of Orange County think that it's all like rich, white, fancy people that live in OC. But like I grew up in a mixed race family in the very specific kind of like bubble that is like a working class town in a very conservative area. And so like my grandpa was really dark and I was really close with my grandpa. And so we would go to the grocery store and I would see the eyes that he would get, not just for like being dark, but also for walking around with a little white kid. People did not know what to make of us, you know. And I actually have a picture of my grandparents right here. Oh, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this. Alice met my grandma. This is my grandpa Arnold. This is my grandma.
Oh,
they were
yes.
crazy. I loved my grandparents so much. But,
yes, Candace's grandmother's
My grandma was also a sex worker, you know, so it was like growing up knowing my grandparents were crazy. My grandpa and my grandma, they were, God bless them, they were the wild child, you know, types of the 60s. They met because my grandma was a stripper at the Playboy Club in Long Beach, and he was a customer.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, knowing all these things, you know, my mom was like a teen mom, you know, my biological dad had left us. Having this very like different like family, right? My family themselves were freaks, you know, like compared to Orange County. And I was the freak of the freaks, you know. But, you know, we were very tight. And so like, just like being from this kind of a family and like always like struggling and seeing my grandpa getting harassed by the cops. I saw my grandpa get arrested as a kid, you know, like our family wasn't perfect, but like, you know, it seeing that stuff like as a kid, like made a really deep impression on me because it wasn't just the theory of racism exists or, you know, sex workers deserve dignity, right? It was like, these are my grandparents,
yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, and just like, yeah, like being a welfare kid, you know, it's like being that kind of a person in a place like Orange County, you are going to have a very weird like relationship to Orange County, right? But the thing is I wasn't alone. It's not like we were the only family like that. Like I always say, for a tourist economy to be really the primary economic driver, what do you need? You need to have a underpaid, underserved class of people to sustain that tourist economy. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, it was interesting because it would be like the Disneyland fireworks were the kind of like the backdrop to a backyard punk show for me as a kid. And we, you know, my mom and I would have to dumpster dive. We would dumpster dive at the grocery outlet on Harbor. So, I mean, just that by itself, regardless of punk, is just like a weird experience that like I didn't realize until I got older, you know? And so like all the stuff of intersectionality, it was like I really understood it like from the time I was a baby, you know? So, yeah, I mean, the thing about the Orange County punk scene, unfortunately, there's also Nazis there. And so punk, my understanding of punk was this mess of like, punk is girlfare, but punk is also Nazis, right? Like, and so like, yeah.
I'm going to
so
differ
think,
there
like,
with you,
a lot of tensions
Candace.
And conundrums has always been a big part of my relationship to like working through punk and working with punk.
Yeah, I'm going to challenge that idea that like those, I just feel like anybody who uses punk to hide behind when they have these like, you know, ridiculous goals. Nazis are not punks. Nazis are Nazis. They're racist. They're, you know, they're pining for a time that's already passed. And same goes for the white supremacists that wear the red hats. You know, it's like, that isn't punk. And you know, if people say that anything can be punk, but that doesn't make any sense because everything is punk, then nothing's punk. You know, just the way that people say that anything can be feminism because a woman said it, and that's not true either. There are real definitions of feminism and real definitions of punk. And punk is inclusive by nature. Punk is challenging the status quo. It's not pining for the good old plantation days of old. And feminism is not longing to be a trad wife, you know, even though some women may prefer that. And they may call themselves feminists, but they're not. So yes, I'm open to debate all of that.
Well, we're going to wrap up on that note because I absolutely agree. And we've been talking to feminist punk icon Alice Bagg and drummer, scholar, and journalist Candace Hansen. And they're going to be appearing Tuesday, March 24th at Cal State LA. It's a special performance. There's a live performance in the music courtyard. It starts at 6 p.m. And then there's a discussion with Alice and Candace. There's a Q&A, autograph session in the music concert hall. And the whole thing is free and open to the public. There's also more info you can find through Instagram. WGSSLA account has some details on that. And we'll have links on our Feminist Magazine website as well. Thank you both for joining us, Alice Bagg.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Candace Hansen. I mean, we could have gone on. We have more to say. But you're going to say it on March 24th at Cal State LA.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting...
Danny is an accordionist. He's dedicated his entire life to the mastery of his craft and to the preservation of the traditional music from his locality in North Kerry.
Broken Talkers Bellow, on March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bellow tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony. A man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft. Tickets and further information is available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
It shines with that. It settles that.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision.
In the shadow of debate over elective abortion, we sat down with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs to talk about a vision for the future that reaches deep into existing wisdom around care and caregiving. It starts with reading folks like June Jordan and Alice Walker.
She says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill that can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself.
The Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Div abortion is only one piece of a larger conversation about reproduction. The reproductive justice movement started in the mid-1990s by Black and Indigenous women argues, rarely do we find ourselves fighting for just one aspect of reproductive justice, such as abortion rights. We sat down with a daughter of the movement, Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs, to talk about a vision for the path forward. Alexis Pauline Gumbs is a queer Black troublemaker and Black feminist love evangelist, founder or the co-founder of several community organizations focused on everything from ending gendered violence to land trust to healing work and all things media. She's a writer with work published in several outlets, 5 books already born, and 1 in gestation called The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. Alexis is a teacher, making access to regular folks a priority. She founded Brilliance Remastered, an online network and series of retreats and online intensives, serving community accountable intellectuals and artists. I have to ask, does this mean our listeners?
Yes.
Okay, great. So it's very exciting. It seems that the uniting theme of all of her work is a passion for the issues that impact oppressed communities and an intimate knowledge of the resilience of movements led by Black, Indigenous, working class women and queer people of color. Today, we're going to be talking about the book, one of your books, one of your babies that you co-edited with China Martins and Maya Williams. This book is really very truly dear to me. Like, it's my friend. And the book is Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. And if it's okay, I wanted to read some praise from Alice Walker.
Oh, I love that.
Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines is juicy, gutsy, vulnerable, and very brave. These women insist on having their children in a society that does not welcome them, in a world that is rapidly falling apart, Their dream for their children, based on their love of them, encompasses the sorrow and the joy that mothers everywhere, whether human, animal, or plant, feel at this time. A radical vision, many radical visions of how to mother in a time of resistance and of pain. There's a beautiful preface in the book by Professor Loretta Ross that it gives it a sort of a rich, almost like sensorial context to the formation of the reproductive justice movement. And in a minute, I am going to ask you to tell me the birth story of the book. Mm-hmm. But first, I was wondering if you could tell me and our listeners the birth story of the reproductive justice movement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the reason that we are so honored that Loretta Ross could have agreed to write a preface for Revolutionary Mothering is that we definitely know that that work wouldn't have been possible for us, imaginable even outside of the context of a reproductive justice movement. And Loretta Ross is one of the founding mothers of that movement. So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision that is about really empowering all of us, but especially the people most impacted by multiple systems of oppression, to have autonomy over what happens with our capacity to create, what happens in terms of our ability to define and create the relationships that we have, the families that we want, the destinies that we want for our own bodies. And its expansiveness is in some way the response of feminists of color, including Loretta Ross, to what they saw as some of the limitations to the idea of reproductive rights, in quotes. And so they wanted to create something that really spoke to the multiple ways that our capacity as beings that are part of a species that can proliferate, that needs each other to survive, that lives and relates in units of community beyond the question of access to abortion or not access to abortion. And also that takes into account the histories of coerced sterilization. It takes into account histories of experimentation with birth control drugs on impoverished women in Puerto Rico. All of these different truth-telling imperatives are part of what makes the reproductive justice movement exist.
I love an intellectual. I have to tell you that. I mean, you know, I'm a nurse, and I don't know if you know other nurses, but, you know, we are very, like, of the earth. And so, like, it is so stimulating to talk to somebody who's kind of the clouds, you know what I mean? Like, in a most,
sure.
in a lovely way. Because I'm thinking, tell me the birth story. And I'm thinking, it was 1994, and these women gathered in Chicago, and they ate at Chipotle, or, you know, and then, right, they went back to the South, and they formed Sister Song, right?
Yes. Also, there's a really important essay in an anthology called The Color of Violence that Insight Women of Color Against Violence published, where Loretta Ross writes her definition of reproductive justice, which I would refer everyone to because that is for me, that's the best way to hear that origin story, aside from if you're very blessed and get to just listen to Loretta Ross or Billy Avery themselves. So there's Sister Song. It was really the space to say, like, to sing what reproductive justice is and to roll that out into the world. And Loretta Ross was the founding executive director of Sister Song. And the Sister Song conferences, the Let's Talk About Sex conferences, became this catalyzing movement space. One of the things that they did that I love is that they had mother-daughter fellowships to go to the conference. And so my mother and I went to Sister Song in Chicago.
That is so beautiful.
Together. I think that at the core of reproductive justice is, and I've heard Loretta Ross recently talk about this as like a reproductive futurity, is that it is intergenerational. It lives in intergenerationality. And they have moved that way the entire time. So in Atlanta, there's a place called Mother House. And this was it's really a house. It was the headquarters for Black Women's Health Project. And just to give a corner to the story, which really probably only I can tell you, when I was a teenage writer growing up in Atlanta, I went to Mother House to the basement to lead a writing workshop and facilitate the creation of a newsletter, like a newsletter about sex for the teenagers. And I was a teenager. They were like children who were part of the summer program that Black Women's Health Project had as part of its initiative for there to be intergenerational conversations about sex and profoundly comprehensive sex education. And so that was actually the first time that as a writer facilitator, I ever was paid to facilitate a writing workshop, which to me keys into this idea of reproductive justice movement generating our creativity in all these multiple ways, right? And then the children, who many of them were children of these same reproductive justice movement workers, just were having these incredible conversations about sexuality and gender and fluidity and justice and autonomy and consent, like all of these things. And so it was a blessing to be able to have an intergenerational view on that from a young age.
It's so cool that you had such a front row seat.
Yeah.
And like how neat that it really ties into the book, I feel like, because a lot of the book that you co-edited is talking about the actual work of mothering as revolutionary work itself. And so this idea that your mother was taking you to these places, she was raising a revolutionary. I mean, look at you now, you know, like she did the work, you know, and now look at you like putting it out into the world in even bigger, further ways. What's the birth story of this book?
Oh, yay. Okay. So it goes back to a internet love story. My would-be future co-editor, Maya, and I met on the internet, and I think we both have been making zines for a long time. We blog, and I think we found each other that way. And Maya was wanting to use a workbook I had made with these women in South Africa who had taken over an abandoned factory to create their own school with their children. And I was like, what? Who is this person? You know, I was like, this is what you do. So Maya is an international human rights worker and journalist. And she, while we were cultivating our friendship, she was traveling all over the world and she was organizing with mothers. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Zapatista movement. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Arab Spring uprising. She was organizing in Palestine, and in all of these spaces, she was telling me what was going on and the revolution.
She was finding the moms.
She was finding the moms, yeah. And she already had a really clear understanding that that is revolutionary. And then she started to create this zine called Revolutionary Motherhood. Meanwhile, I am in the archive researching. I'm working on my PhD, and my dissertation is called We Can Learn to Mother Ourselves, The Queer Survival of Black Feminism. And so I'm looking at everything that these feminists of color are saying about mothering in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s. And so I'm looking through Audre Lorde's papers. I'm looking through June Jordan's papers. I'm looking through finding these Azalea and the Salsa Soul Sister Gazette and, you know, all of these out of print publications that are basically ancestors to our zines that we're creating. And I'm telling her what I find, right? And so she's like, listen to what happened in Gaza. And I'm like, listen to what June Jordan said in 1977, you know? And at some point we were like, okay, this conversation that we're having is actually a real conversation. Like we are meant to put together this archive and legacy of a revolutionary approach to mothering and contemporary people who are living this and practicing it right now. So we should create an anthology. This is our idea. And then we met China Martins, who's our would-be co-editor, at the Allied Media Conference. And China's like almost a generation older than Maya and I. Maya and I are pretty close in age. And China is like zine's forerunner. Like she was the first person to write mothering zines about being a mother, about raising a kid on welfare. She was really the first. And The Future Generation is the name of her zine. And so we were like, yes, you know, like this is our trifecta dream team. At the beginning, we thought we were going to call it This Bridge Called My Baby. And when we sent out our call for submissions, that's what we said. And we're creating an anthology called This Bridge Called My Baby. And, you know, so many people sent in essays and poems and stories. And we were like, whoa, this is amazing. And we started this process of the intensive work of creating an anthology. And it took like 7 years before it actually existed in print. Anyway, so the reason that we created this book was because we really felt that there was something to be said about, again, intergenerationally, what it means to really just shine light on a revolutionary approach to mothering, right? Because we're very clear, like, we're not creating that. It's something very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to us that, we were like over the moon, ready to pass out when Alice Walker wrote that blurb, because her idea of democratic motherism, it talks about mothering as a form of being in the world and really as the ethical form of being in the world, and that it can include everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in that essay where she says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill. It can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself. And so the deepest thing that we wanted recognition for all of this revolutionary labor that we're naming as revolutionary mothering that has been happening for generations, and without which certainly the three of us wouldn't exist as who we are, or maybe at all. And it's possible to think that maybe life wouldn't exist, right? There are these constant acts of life-giving and care that are transformative and revolutionary because they exist right up against these forms of repression that have seemingly done everything to eradicate them.
Wow. That's quite a birth story.
Yes. Thank you for asking.
Well, I have to tell you, like, the reason why I reached out to you recently about doing this interview and talking about this book that was published in 2016, you know, it's not like there's like a timely stamp on this or whatever, except that there is.
Right.
Because I have to tell you, I was raised in central Indiana by lesbian pastors. I have this tendency that I think is residual from my raising that is during times of stress or confusion, like to go to text. Protestants love their Bible study. So I don't really turn to the Bible, but I go to my bookshelf. And I feel like all of our different states and communities are pretty much trying to decide who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I have not heard the word abortion so much ever in my life before being discussed openly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, are there other things that you think people could be reading right now as they're kind of grappling with whatever is happening in their communities?
I mean, of course, people we've mentioned, right? Alice Walker is somebody who to always read, but I would say especially her essay. When we think about abortion, she's somebody who's been very open about the fact that this is a part of her experience and her early politicization as a young woman, a young college student, and she has this expansive perspective that I draw on over and over again. So read more Alice Walker. June Jordan, definitely. And I'll just say the essay that we were so honored to print in Revolutionary Mothering is called The Creative Spirit in Children's Literature. And this is the place where June Jordan makes the proclamation that love is life force. And this is a talk that she gave at a conference about children's literature at Berkeley in California in 1977. And the first sentence is just, love is life force. That's it. The end. Like, that's everything right there. And she goes on to offer this incredible, expansive definition of what creativity is, what creation is, and how it exists within all species. And then she talks about the accountability of what our intergenerational conversation is, right? So what's at stake in children's literature for June Jordan is, what is the possible conversation we can have between generations? And she just goes deep into, like, what is it? What are the fears that brings up in adults? What's disrespectful about not talking about certain things with young people?
And before we get away from it, I do want to, if it's okay, I want to read, like, just a very short piece from this essay that you're making reference to, if it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
June Jordan says, "And it seems to me that love, that is serious and tender concern to respect the nature and the spontaneous purpose of other things, other people, will make manifest a peaceable order among us, such that fear, conflict, competition, waste, and environmental sacrifice will have no place." That passage means a lot. Yeah. It's like, that's everything. Like, what else is there
to say? That's everything, like, right? Said. It's everything that we need. Like, we would do this one thing.
Yeah.
We would do this one thing.
We could just, like, live like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I can never get too much of June Jordan. So I turn to so many. I turn to Angela Davis. I turn to my dear sister, Adrienne Marie Brown. I turn to Walida E. Marisha. I turn, of course, to Loretta Ross. So I'm a creative writing editor at the journal Feminist Studies. And there's a resource on the Feminist Studies website that, in response to the Supreme Court decision, that we decided to create. And it kind of chronicles, because this is an issue that is in the journal all the time. But it chronicles an archive going back, it's 50 years that this journal has existed. You could look at that to give kind of a long view of how feminist thinkers have been writing about this over time. There's so much reading to do.
We're jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact and an interview with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums. Visit us online at radioproject.org, where you can join the conversation with a comment. And now back to the show. And we've talked about reading. We've talked about holding workshops. Is there anything else that you're doing to find hope right now, or kind of manage yourself and your community?
Yeah, I think the other things on a smaller scale has just been more reaching out. You know, like, I have kind of had to get over it. And even me being like, oh, nobody wants to really hear from me, or, oh, I can't, you know, like, let me stay within the boundary of not reaching out even to people I do know, or like my own friends, you know, like that's been a thing that I've struggled with. And now I see, I'm like, oh, that's complicit in the forms of isolation that those who would harm all of us want to exist, so that we don't acknowledge our collective power, right? And act accordingly. And so that's definitely been a way. I am not a nurse, but I'm like a major distributor of just raspberry leaf to people, you know, like, it's just, yes. I'm like, this will help. You know, I have my little peppermint raspberry leaf.
Your tincture. Yeah. And your witchy
the tea,
brews.
You know, all of that. And, and also just that practice for myself, you know, I mean, it's tied to what Loretta Ross is talking about, this legacy of us taking care of ourselves and each other and learning what that takes in relationship with the natural world.
Taking care of yourself is revolution. Taking care of your children is revolution. As a mom of human babies, it doesn't always feel that way. It is work that is unseen and unappreciated by capitalism completely. And so it, you know, to all you moms out there, keep your head up like you're doing it.
Yes.
And to all the people who are doing mothering work that isn't to human babies, it's important work too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that our dream for revolutionary mothering includes. It's to say that the exact isolation that you're talking about, where capitalism pretends to not value the labor of mothering, but it needs it.
It needs it.
At the same time,
doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it?
That is what we want to shine a light on. All of those acts of care, the disgusting, you know, someone spitting up on you, you know, all those things are happening. Those have such revolutionary potential. And what would a world be like where we valued that in such a way that the actual labor of it wasn't isolated either, right? And that is, in fact, dangerous to capitalism. It's certainly dangerous to any system that would want to disempower anyone, but particularly disempower women, because, there's too much love. There's too much love and creativity. And when we collaborate on it,
that's some powerful stuff.
That's it. Love is life force.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
So thank you so much for having me.
I've been your host, Amy Gastelum.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Coming up this week on LA Theater Works.
She's one of theater's most famous characters. She's passionate, cunning, and very, very bored.
I must say there were many times on the trip when I longed for a third person. But it was always just the two of us, alone together in yet another little railway compartment.
Hedda Gabler by Henrik Ibsen, next time on LA Theater Works.
That's this Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. LA Theater Works right here on KPFK.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
I'm Esty Chandler from Middle East in Focus. Author Phyllis Bennis will be discussing her most recent book, Understanding Palestine and Israel, at Midnight Books on Friday, March 27th at 7 p.m. and at Watermelon Books on Sunday, March 29th at 4 p.m. Co-sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace Los Angeles, the Institute for Policy Studies, and KPFK. More information available at kpfk.org.